Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's podcast is brought to you again by 8 Sleep, and we're going to talk about what they can actually do for getting you through these hot summer nights. So one of the big questions that I have sitting up here in the upper Midwest is whether or not, and I'm going to continue arguing throughout the cycle that Wisconsin is the most interesting political state in the country because that's what I do, but I'm willing to concede for today that Texas is the big one. And the question I keep asking myself is all this speculation about Texas possibly flipping, Texas going blue, is that just another one of these Lucy in the football things? Because we have heard this before, and Democrats have turned it into a big money pit. But there's a number of indications it might actually be in play. So we decided we're going to reach out to the people who are actually on the ground and know all of this, and we're joined by Patrick Svitek, who is the primary political correspondent for the Texas Tribune. Hey, Patrick, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, you, we were just talking about this beforehand. You're a graduate of Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, and you're from Indiana, and somehow you took a wrong turn somewhere, and you, as opposed to the Midwest, you ended up down in Texas.
Exactly, and I was born in New England, too, I should add, so it's been a fun path.
Oh, okay, so, you know, I have here in front of me Josh Krashauer's piece from the National Journal, where he's basically you know teeing up this question about Texas, that you know, despite President Trump's win in 2016, he only carried Texas by 9 points, nearly matching his margin of victory in traditional swing states like Iowa and Ohio. And unlike the GOP trending Midwestern battleground states, which have all kinds of blue-collar white voters, Texas has one of the most diverse and suburban populations in the entire country. It is eventually going to become a presidential battleground if it isn't already. So the real question is, will 2020 be the year, and this is Josh's question, when Trump's boorish nativism will turn the state purple? So let's just, like, you know, get right to it here. Is Texas really in play in 2020, do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I think it is, and I think it's important to look at the past, kind of how we got here, at least in recent history. If you look at the past kind of 3 or 4 election cycles in Texas, it's funny you mentioned the idea of having a Lucy in the football moment, because that's exactly what the 2014 cycle was like in Texas. If you recall, that was when these former Obama aides created this group, Battleground Texas. Wendy Davis was running for governor against Greg Abbott. There was a lot of hype and a lot of excitement and a lot of feeling of it being within reach for Democrats that cycle. And of course, we all know how that went. Not only did Wendy Davis lose in the governor's race by over 20 points, but you saw an even more kind of conservative class of Republican statewide officials come into office. And it actually looked like in that 14 cycle that Texas was at the statewide level, at least, going in the opposite direction, that it wasn't a turn Texas blue cycle. It was a turn Texas even redder cycle. That obviously coincided with a 2014 was obviously a big year nationally for Republicans, and that helped as well. And so that cycle was definitely kind of a Lucy in the football moment, as you put so finely earlier. And then you fast forward to 16, and as you pointed out, you know, Trump, you know, the big change, of course, was Trump comes along. And if you look at the and I think you pointed this out as well, you know, he won Texas by just 9 percentage points, after the previous Republican nominees easily won the state in recent history by double digits. That 9-point margin was the same or similar to Trump's margins in Ohio and Iowa, of course. And, you know, in the shadow of that, you had some of these congressional seats in Texas start to kind of look like they may be in play. And that really set the table for the 2018 cycle, which is where all this suddenly gets this kind of fluid political landscape in Texas gets supercharged, basically.
Well, and this becomes the question. So is 2018, is are we seeing a realignment, or is this a blip here? Because, you know, I was down in Texas before the election, and didn't expect Beto to win despite all of the hype, but I was certainly surprised. I think a lot of people were surprised that he came within 3 points. Is that right? I mean, 3 points in a state like Texas. And some of the areas that he won in Texas were rather stunning. He flipped some of the counties that had been reliably Republican and ran up huge margins in some of the urban areas. So first of all, just for our listeners, though, give me some sense of what did happen down ballot. Beto didn't win, but it certainly was a good night for Democrats in general in Texas. Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. So going into that 2018 election cycle, just based on the Trump results in three congressional districts, the national Democrats were targeting them. That was Will Hurd's seat, which is always a battleground in Texas. It's drawn to be a battleground in Texas. And then there was John Culberson's seat in Houston and Pete Sessions' seat in Dallas. Both Culberson and Sessions were, relatively longtime incumbents who never really had to run very competitive races of their own in the past. Obviously, Pete Sessions, the former chairman of the NRCC, so he certainly knew what a competitive race was like, but never really know what it was like to have one in his backyard. And in the down ballot gains that happened that cycle, you had Pete Sessions lose, you had John Culberson lose. Will Hurd hung on by 926 votes. And so Texas Democrats, when you talk about those down ballot gains underneath O'Rourke, they picked up two out of three congressional seats that they were targeting. And then in the state legislature, and I think this is where the real impact was felt and where you really see a real potential opportunity for Democrats in 2020, you had them in 2018 pick up two state Senate seats and then pick up 12 state House seats, which is pretty significant because that brought them within nine seats of the majority. And so, there's a lot of opportunity for Democrats in Texas this cycle, but I think one that, is somewhat underappreciated right now and is probably just going to continue to get more attention as folks, squint and look a little closer at Texas is the fact that the Texas House could very much be in play this cycle in Texas. And that obviously has huge implications for redistricting in 2021.
So what is happening in Texas is, and this comes to the question of demographics. Are people changing their minds? Are former Republican voters voting Democratic, or is the nature of the electorate changing? And by that I mean also what is happening in the suburbs and in the ethnic composition of the electorate. There's kind of a mixed question there. What are you seeing changing on the ground from 2014, where basically it was an absolute blowout for Republicans, to 2020, where people are going, my sense is the Republicans are kind of looking over their shoulder and going, oh my God, we lose Texas. We lose the Electoral College for a generation. What is the nut of this transformation?
Yeah, I think like nationally, the story of the transformation here, at least in the past couple of cycles, can be summed up by looking at the suburbs. I mean, that's where Beto O'Rourke made the most striking inroads in 2018. That's where these down ballot gains were kind of the most pronounced. As you pointed out earlier, he not only made strong inroads in the traditionally Republican suburbs, but he also was able to drive up turnout in the urban areas. And Texas is contrary, I think, to some popular belief, Texas is a very urban state. I mean, they're an overwhelming majority of the population lives in the cities in Texas and in the kind of exurban areas, and then also the suburban areas and the collar counties. And so those are very important voting centers. And it's not, rural Texas is certainly not enough to carry Republicans anymore. And in fact, if I remember doing this math after the 2018 election, if you look at the rural and non-rural counties, you had Ted Cruz won the rural counties, but lost the non-rural counties, aka the urban suburban counties, which is kind of the first time in recent history that the Republican at the top of the ticket did that. Usually a Republican running statewide in Texas, they run up the score in those rural counties and then they keep it. They have like kind of a single digit margin. If you look at the urban and suburban counties all combined, O'Rourke won the urban and suburban counties combined in Texas, which again was kind of the first time you saw a Democratic statewide candidate do that in recent history. And so, but going back to just kind of the top line question, I think it's definitely the suburbs. And I think that Democrats, even though they're feeling really good about this cycle, or what happened in the past cycle and what could happen this upcoming cycle, they acknowledge that they still need to do a better job in turning out and fully mobilizing the Latino vote, and other, minority groups in Texas. Because I although O'Rourke made, I think, a very commendable effort to reach those voters and to campaign for those voters, he certainly, you know, did in his effort. I don't think he turned them out at the kind of level that Democrats need to really return to statewide dominance in Texas. So that is still, I think, a checkbox for them heading into this next cycle.
But that is sort of one of those wild cards that if, in fact, there was a significant increase in Hispanic turnout, Hispanic registration, that would be kind of a game changer in Texas, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been kind of, you know, that has been true cycle after cycle. And, you know, you also, and another factor there is too, you also have the Republicans, you know, for all the, you know, weaknesses that have been exposed in their political, you know, campaigns over the past cycle. You know, some of them, including the governor, Greg Abbott, will be interesting what John Cornyn does in 2018 or 2020, but some of them have made a real effort to reach out to the Hispanic community in terms of how they run their campaigns and where they focus their resources. And so it's certainly not a monolithic voting block, and it's not one that some of the top Republicans in the state are just willing to concede to Democrats.
I want to go back to these voter numbers on urban counties, and I don't have it in front of me, so I may be misremembering it, or the numbers may be completely wrong. You correct me on this.
Okay.
That somebody was pointing out that if you take the five most urban counties in Texas, that Barack Obama won by about 80,000 votes, that Beto O'Rourke won by a margin of 800,000 votes. So that the Democratic counties have become just, and I think you made this point, have become dramatically more Democratic and are turning out much bigger margins, which again changes this formula of what you need to do to win statewide in Texas. Do those numbers sound like remotely right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that absolutely sounds right. I mean, one great example of this is Harris County, which is home to Houston. It used to be a battleground county as of maybe, you know, two or three cycles ago. And, you know, it just went totally under, you know, in 2018, just went solidly blue and everyone saw it coming and no one was really shocked. And, you know, it is it's maybe the third or fourth most populous county in the country. And it's obviously home to a lot of voters here in Texas. But, you know, again, a county that used to be a very solid battleground county and one that Republicans, I think Mitt Romney won it narrowly in 2012. This past election cycle, it flipped like nothing. No one batted a lash.
So I want to talk about Beto O'Rourke, and I want to talk about the president's visit to El Paso in just a moment. But first, I want to talk about our sponsor today. Pod is the high-tech solution to hot summer nights. This summer is smashing heat records from Silicon Valley to Brooklyn. You know how tough it is to sleep during a heat wave. So get this, there's actually a bed that keeps you cool through the whole night, no matter how hot it is outside. The Pod by 8 Sleep is the first and only bed with responsive surface technology designed to keep you cool all night long. The Pod is the Tesla of beds. The Pod dynamically adjusts each side of the bed to the ideal temperature of your body, which science shows can help you sleep deeper. You, by the way, knew that, right? Leading to optimal mind and body performance the next day. You'll find that 8 Sleep is a company dedicated to building the most innovative solutions for sleep's biggest problems. And with the Pod, they're delivering. You'll never have to suffer through sweaty hot nights ever again. If you are ready to beat the sweat and start optimizing your sleep, head to 8sleep.com/bulwark. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup. They've already sold out their first two batches, so they are going very fast. So for a limited time, here's the deal. You can get $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's E-I-G-H-T sleep.com/bulwark. Okay, we are back talking with Patrick Svitek of the Texas Tribune, primary political correspondent. So here's my question about Beto O'Rourke. He was the phenom of 2018, raised he raised more than $50 million. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well above that, yeah.
I mean, well above. I mean, it was just ridiculous. it was, you know, blank you money. Came within 3 points, did not win. and this propelled him into national prominence. His presidential campaign has, shall we say, not had the same energy as the Senate campaign. So give me your take on Beto O'Rourke. Was he overrated as a Senate candidate? I sort of have the feeling that the moment he stepped into the presidential race, he was kind of exposed. He was exposed as a guy that everybody loved when he was running against Ted Cruz, but was really not ready for the big stage.
Yeah. And if I could just quickly correct something I said earlier, in 2012, when we were talking about Harris County, it was actually Mitt Romney narrowly lost it by tenth of a percentage point. But just to illustrate the trend, you have Mitt Romney losing it by a tenth of a percentage point in 2012. To fast forward to 2018, and Beto O'Rourke carries it by double digits. So again, you know, once battleground county, not even really competitive anymore, if you look at just those, that shift there. But getting back to O'Rourke in the presidential race, I think a big factor for him right now, or as he headed into this race, was indeed the fact that he's now running a national Democratic primary, very crowded field. He no longer has a singular opponent in Ted Cruz. He ran a Senate race that was not, you know, exclusively focused on running against Cruz, but I think that was certainly a part of the draw to him, just given how polarizing Cruz is and how much people, Democrats and even some independents, a lot of independents and some Republicans hate Cruz in Texas. I think that was for him, that was a probably tougher than expected shift in terms of being able to be a galvanizing figure when you're running against Ted Cruz in Texas versus running against 19 to 20 other Democrats in the national environment. And so I think that he's had a little trouble navigating that. I think he's at his strongest, I think, as just a political figure when, he has a singular opponent, or he is also kind of seen as sticking up for the border, which is obviously a huge part of his political rise and his personal story. And that's why I think he's, you know, finally kind of finding his voice and his footing right now, in the wake of this massacre in El Paso, because he is still very much a hometown hero to El Paso, obviously not representing it in Congress anymore, but represented it for a number of terms, and when he ran for U.S. Senate, engendered just an immense amount of pride in El Pasoans, who, again, in Texas, El Paso is kind of in its own world, both geographically and politically. And so, it's never really a part of the statewide political conversation. I think that the statistic that I love to recite to people is that El Paso physically is closer to San Diego, California, than it is to Beaumont, Texas, on the east end of the state. And so it really is, it really is its own world in some ways. And so that just adds, I think, to the amount of pride that people in El Paso have when they see one of their own, not only burst onto the statewide stage, but burst onto the national stage. And so that just, I think, again, kind of illustrates why El Paso is such an important part of his story, and why I think right now in the wake of this shooting, he's shining as much as he is.
This may be a slight digression, but you reminded me of something that surprises non-Texans, I think, a lot, is how huge Texas is.
Yeah.
When you're describing El Paso as being almost, its own world, when you look at the map, how far it is from much of the rest of the state. But let's go to this, because the president, of course, singled him out. Donald Trump is going to bring his healing powers to El Paso. That should go well. And the president decided that it's almost like clockwork. The president gives the speech where he reads from the teleprompter about, that we need to come together. We need to stop the vicious partisanship, and, says all the right words. And then, of course, 48 hours later, what is he doing? He is tweeting out attacks on Beto O'Rourke, telling him to be quiet. Obviously, from Beto O'Rourke's point of view, this is kind of a gift that the president, Trump does seem a little obsessed with him, doesn't he? I mean, even though he's not one of the top three candidates, there's something about him that seems to have gotten under Donald Trump's skin.
Yeah, no, I think he definitely takes, some, additional enthusiasm in attacking and going after O'Rourke, than he does some of these other candidates, especially those who, at least by the polling numbers, would present themselves as a much greater threat to Trump's reelection than O'Rourke. I mean, I think, in O'Rourke, Trump sees a pretty reliable foil when it comes to the border. They clearly have totally different visions when it comes to how they talk about, you know, immigrant communities, and also in terms of the policies they support. And so I think it is just a, you know, a vivid contrast that, that, you know, both of them are happy to lean into. Of course, you know, Trump is doing it in a more cynical way. If you look at just the language and the fact that he chose to tweet that on the eve of a, you know, a visit to El Paso in the wake of a mass shooting. But I think there's, again, in style and substance, there's definitely a vivid contrast there between them when it comes to the border.
Yeah, the tweet reads, Beto, and then in parentheses, phony name to indicate Hispanic heritage. O'Rourke, who is embarrassed by my last visit to the great state of Texas where I trounced him, and is even more embarrassed by polling at 1% in the Democrat primary, should respect the victims and law enforcement and be quiet. Obviously, he's not going to be quiet. You know, I guess I'm just so struck by the juvenile rhetoric of Donald Trump still, because I'm trying not to be, you know, not to normalize all of this. But you make the point that Beto O'Rourke is still incredibly popular down in El Paso. So what is your take on the president's visit down there? I mean, the last time that, you know, he was there, you know, he's talking about the murderers, the killings. He has, you know, he's mischaracterized El Paso as basically this battleground. His rhetoric has obviously been tied rather directly to what happened down there. How is he going to be received? How does this look from the ground down there that Donald Trump, the guy who will never heal this country, is trying to play the role of healer in chief today with that visit?
Yeah, I think among El Paso officials, I mean, it's mainly a Democratic city. But, you know, among El Paso officials, I think at best there's overwhelming discomfort with him coming, and at worst there's outright, you know, hostility to him coming. I don't think a lot of folks in leadership in that city believe that he's going to make the situation any better by being there. Obviously, as you pointed out, the anti-immigrant racist rhetoric and you know, policies that he's pushed are really at odds with how that city views itself and views its place in America, and how it views its place, I guess, in North America. You know, there's just a tremendous amount of pride in that city, as voiced by people like O'Rourke, you know, in the fact that they are a bustling city, a binational city, linked by the border. And you can, you know, look up any O'Rourke stump speech and probably hear it more eloquently than that. But that I think really speaks to the pride of that city. And, you know, they view Trump as kind of, Trump's rhetoric and actions as, you know, an all out assault on that sense of community and identity that they have being on the border.
Okay, let's go back to 2020. If it's a very good night for Democrats, and Josh Krasauer points this out, it's plausible that they might win Texas's 38 electoral votes, which is pretty much the whole game, 38 electoral votes, pick up 4 to 5 of the state's House seats, and give Senator John Cornyn a run for his money. So one last Beto O'Rourke question. I was on MSNBC yesterday, and somebody was, you know, touting, you know, O'Rourke's presidential prospects and for flipping Texas. And when it was my turn, I said, you know, if Beto O'Rourke really wanted to flip Texas, maybe he ought to drop out of the presidential race and run for Senate. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of people in Texas who figured, hey, you know, why don't you stay here? I mean, I know there's a lot of other Democrats that are in this race, but at least on the outside, it doesn't look like any of them have the kind of juice that Beto O'Rourke would have if he got into that Senate race. So is that just not going to happen?
Right now, I think that's unlikely, but it is true that he would be a field clearing figure. Right now, you know, the biggest, you know, if you're someone who wants John Cornyn unseated, if you're a Democrat or someone else, the biggest kind of gift to John Cornyn right now is how slow to develop and how crowded this Democratic primary has become. It now features several candidates, 5 to 10 candidates, you know, maybe 4 to 6, or, you know, 3 or 4 that you can say are really serious. And so the Democrats are going to have to, you know, spend some obvious time and money figuring out who their nominee is going to be. And we have runoffs in Texas. And so if no one gets 50% or more of the vote in the March primary, that goes to a May runoff. And so you may not have a Democratic nominee against John Cornyn, you know, fully minted until mid-May, which is pretty late in the cycle. And also, I mean, you know, to be clear, Texas is still not a full-blown battleground state. This is still a state where statewide Democrats, you know, regardless of whether you're Beto O'Rourke or someone else, you still face an uphill climb. And so you need to be, you know, being able to campaign as hard as possible for the general election as early as possible. And so I think there's some concern there that that primary has gotten muddled. And I think that's why you're seeing kind of a new outcry for O'Rourke to come back and run. You know, he has not shown any openness to that. People around him don't seem particularly interested in seeing him do that. But you know, I think that could potentially change if we go another few months and this current Democratic primary field doesn't, show overt signs of strength. But yeah, again, I would, to be clear, I think it's unlikely.
Oh, no, and I know it's unlikely, but I also remember the whole Marco Rubio scenario in Florida where everybody thought he's obviously not going to run for a re-election for the Senate if the presidential thing doesn't work out, but that did in fact work out for him. Now, I got a sense on social media that people in the Beto camp were not interested in hearing the suggestion that he run for Senate. Somebody said, and then they went to this little bitch Charlie Sykes who said, and what I tweeted out was, okay, I may be a little bitch, but I still think it is good advice. Okay, so now tell me about the impact of all of these retirements in the last week of Texas Republicans, starting with Will Hurd, which really came as a shock, both in Texas and in Washington, D.C., because it wasn't that long ago that he was a rising star, that he was the future of the Republican Party. Obviously, always a swing seat. You mentioned that earlier. So he is out, and what is it now? We're up to five?
Four, I believe. Four. So you have Mike Conaway, you have Will Hurd, you have Pete Olson, and then you also have Kenny Marchant, the most recent one. But definitely of those four, Will Hurd is the most devastating to Republicans in that district in Texas, nationally. Obviously, he is the only Black Republican in the House. But in Texas, I mean, he has been viewed as kind of a uniquely strong incumbent and perhaps the only kind of Republican who can hold on to that district. I think with him retiring, that immediately goes from a toss-up district to a lean Democratic district. He has worked really hard in that district, gotten to know that district very well. I don't know how familiar you are with the geography of the district, but it's massive, San Antonio to El Paso, I think 10 hours to drive across it. It's bigger than several states, and it covers hundreds of miles of Texas-Mexico border. And so it's a really challenging district to represent and to campaign in. And I think that a lot of folks viewed him as having kind of cracked the code. And it'll be very interesting to see what that Republican primary looks like, because, again, I think folks looked at him as kind of a uniquely strong incumbent for that district. But make no mistake that the landscape was, you know, even within the context of it being a battleground, a perennial battleground district, the landscape in that district was continuing to shift away from him. His margins of victory were getting smaller and smaller up until 2018, where he won by just, I think, again, 926 votes. Again, even though he was a strong candidate, the landscape was shifting under his feet.
Well, and also what was interesting about that is that of all of the House Republicans, Hurd was one of the few who was willing to break with Donald Trump and to criticize Donald Trump and to have his own identity. And clearly, what I think you saw in 2018 was that if you do that, you might lose Republican support, but you're not necessarily going to win any Democrats. And I think that's become part of the narrative of people say, look at Will Hurd. I mean, Will Hurd's doing all these things that people on the left say, when are you going to speak up against Donald Trump? He does it, and he doesn't get any. There's no addition there. So the Democrats are targeting about six yes. House seats, and Trump. But really has won a majority in five of them, but not by huge margins. I'm just looking at Josh's piece. Trump won 50% of the vote in Marchant's seat, 52% in the districts of Chip Roy, Michael McCaul, and retiring Pete Wilson, 53% in the district of John Carter. So those are all clearly battleground congressional seats. That's a lot in one state.
Yeah, it's a huge battlefield, and it's becoming an even more competitive battlefield now that you have, again, those three open seats, Olson, Hurd, and Marchant. Conaway, obviously, I'm familiar with his district, but it's one of the reddest in the country, not part of the DCCC battlefield and very unlikely to flip. Six seats, and it's becoming even more competitive with these open seats.
Obviously, it matters which direction the Democrats go. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that obviously, because I get blowback every time I say those kinds of things. But one of the reasons why people are looking at Texas and going, is it possibly a battleground, was that one poll showing Joe Biden in a statistical tie with Donald Trump. So, you know, give me your sense about the various Democratic candidates, the leading Democratic candidates. Could Elizabeth Warren win in Texas?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the limited polling that's been done so far, I mean, you've seen polls that have had, you know, as many as several of the Democratic presidential candidates leading Trump in Texas or within the, you know, within the margin of error. I mean, I you know, again, you see a little more strength from Biden because he's the kind of, you know, tentative national front runner, and you see a little more strength from O'Rourke because he's obviously just ran statewide here and is such a well-known entity. But if you look at some of these polls, I mean, you could make a case that, you know, there's at least the names that are being tested, none of them are like far outside the range of possibility that they could carry Texas, which is, I think, a pretty striking, you know, a pretty striking thing if you're Republicans, that it's not just one of these Democratic presidential candidates that may have unique strength in Texas. It's not just Beto O'Rourke. It's, you know, it's a number of them.
Well, one last question. In the wake of the shootings, George P. Bush was one of the strongest voices denouncing white nationalism. And really did separate himself from a lot of the other Texas Republicans. So tell me about his position in Texas politics right now. Where does he fit in?
Yeah, so he's the land commissioner, not one of the most high profile statewide offices. Yeah, you know, he just ran for re-election in 2018 and had a pretty competitive primary. He won by a pretty wide margin, but he had to work for it. And part of that, you know, somewhat ironically, you know, is that he had to embrace Trump in that primary.
Yeah.
The last, I think it was the last weekend or two before the primary day, I remember seeing TV ads where, you know, it was linking, you know, his work at the Texas Land General Land Office to like kind of helping the Trump administration. I mean, it was really making the case that he was a Trump ally. And so, you know, again, you know, and I'll give George P. Bush credit for definitely being more mindful as an elected official of where the Texas Republican Party is going and what it needs to change to become a more diverse and inclusive party. He's no doubt emphasized that. But again, I mean, as I just pointed out, he's also had to embrace Trump, you know, for political reality reasons. And that, you know, I think perfectly illustrates the tightrope that some of these guys are walking as we head into these next few election cycles in Texas.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised that he went so Trumpy, but apparently that's just simply the nature of Republican politics these days. Patrick Svitek, thank you so much for spending time with us. Patrick is the primary political correspondent for the Texas Tribune and the editor of The Blast, which is the Tribune's subscription-only daily newsletter for political insiders. And apparently there's a lot of political geeks down in Texas, aren't there? I mean, that is a geeked out state when it comes to politics.
Yeah, there's no shortage, especially nowadays.
I didn't even have a chance to get into, but you mentioned that there's a chance that Democrats could take over your House of Representatives, the state legislature. And there's just a nasty intramural fight going on there with the speaker, isn't there? I mean, these people are really at each other.
Yeah, I mean, right now it continues to be a very kind of inside baseball thing, and I'm not ready to say that it's going to have a, you know, significant impact on the 2020 election cycle. But it is, you know, what has basically happened is that the House Speaker was accused a couple weeks ago of meeting with a kind of, a guy who's a prominent figure in the conservative activist movement here, and basically, you know, with a lieutenant striking kind of a quid pro quo deal, offering this conservative activist and his media organization media credentials if they agree only to engage in a limited number of primary battles this election cycle. And, you know, over the past couple of weeks, we've seen the House Speaker kind of evolve on his response to that. Initially, you know, kind of
evolve.
To put it very generously, initially, you know, forcefully denying it, then, you know, kind of softening on that up until yesterday, where he came out and admitted that he said some very terrible things in this meeting. And, you know, I think a lot of people at this point are more inclined to believe the activist's account of the events. And so it's thrown that the Texas House into chaos. You know, ahead of an election cycle where House Republicans really need to keep the waters calm and not give Democrats any opportunities to exploit their divisions.
All right, Patrick, thanks for spending so much time with us. I appreciate it very, very much.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you by 8sleep.com. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will be doing this all over again.